You're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
And we're live here. Actually, there was no timer at all, as I was just telling you guys. but welcome, everyone. I'm Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network and the Within the Trenches podcast, and this is going to be a special episode of Within the Trenches. This is episode number 45. And the reason this is special is because we are doing our first Google Plus Hangout. And as we've been doing lately with the podcast, we have podcast promotions. And the feature for this week is going to be 911trainer.com. Now, I'm going to try to do this screen share here so that everybody can see what's going on. And let me pull this up. It'll take me just one moment. All right, so this is 911trainer.com, and we just started partnering up with them to share interest in links. And one of the first things I can tell you is you can see us right here. You can find us on 911trainer.com. It shows Ricardo's 911 podcast, here, the 911 experience. Now if you click here and you will go straight to our website, and you'll be able to find out more about my co-host Whitney and I, how this got started, what we've been doing, and you can also come down to see a player for Spreaker. And this is where a lot of our episodes are held, as well as iTunes and Stitcher Radio. But for this one right here on the website, if you click this button down here, you'll be able to see every single episode, or listen to every single episode that we've done. So back over here to the 911trainer.com. I've gone through the site. It's an excellent site. It's very easy to use. They do 911 simulations, different training, and in their 911 store, they have freebies. Now, who doesn't like freebies? I know I do. There's a lot of different things that you can get from here. There's free 911 call taking webinars, and it shows right here that it's all for free. So you can check those out. They also have a blog section. You can find them on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. They also have some articles that went to 911 Magazine, and there's nothing else that I can say really that can do justice for the website. So just make sure to check it out. It's 911trainer.com, and you'll be able to find out some excellent information there. So now back to the show. As I said, this is a very special episode, and today, usually I would have my co-host Whitney with me, but she is pretty sick today, and at the last minute she had to check out, and I know exactly what she's going through, because just about a week ago I was doing some training, and we were doing training for a mapping system for one of the dispatch centers over in Indiana, and I was sick like you would not believe. I mean, it was crazy. I hit it very well, though. Even though my mouth was all watery and I was sweating and stuff, it was crazy. But I got through it, and I'm feeling 100% now, so I know exactly how she's doing. Whitney, I hope you get better and get better fast. So today I have with me Gary Allen. How's it going?
Very good, Ricardo.
Excellent. It's nice to have you here. And also we have Ryan. It looks like we lost you there for just a moment, but it looks like you're back now. And like I said, this is our first time doing this, and this is live. So, anything could happen, just like in dispatch. So starting with Gary, if we can just give us a little introduction on what you do, and we'll go from there.
Well, I am now managing a website for public safety communications, 911dispatch.com, and I've been doing that for, on the website the last 10 or 11 years. And before that, I was writing for the printed version of that publication
Okay.
For about 10 years before that. So it began by, it was originally a newsletter founded by Alan Burton, who happened to work here in California where I live. Mm-hmm. And he handed off the printed publication to me, but then eventually, as the internet sort of grew and printed things diminished,
right,
I transitioned it into a website only. So that's what I do now. In my former life, I was a dispatcher for 20 years mm-hmm. here in California, and also spent about 2 years right in the middle of that time working for a computer-aided dispatch software company as a technical writer.
Oh, really?
So I've got kind of a different experience there in terms of sort of the corporate world and then government world on either side.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, I've gone through the site and I've read a lot of the stuff, and the part that I like the most actually is the library, your tape library that you have. And Whitney and I have, you know, we asked for permission. We were able to use some of those tapes or some of the episodes so that people could listen. And you know, that's really good for people to be able to go to and listen to and learn from. So, you know, thank you for having all of those tapes on there.
You're welcome. It is. It's a great resource, and it sort of feeds back into sort of Alan Burton's original focus on the dispatcher at a console. And that's really sort of what I write to, not necessarily managers or 911 directors, but people sitting at a console plugged in with their earphones, a microphone, and there are a lot of tapes there that you might only hear once in a lifetime, if that, wherever you're working. But if you listen to some of those tapes, you can get the benefit of somebody else who's already handled a specific type of incident, and in some cases, very critical incident. And to listen to it and to just to, you know, sort of take mental notes about how it went, how it occurred, and how that particular dispatcher handled it,
right,
for good or ill, I should say, it gives you sort of a mental one-up if it were ever to happen to you, again, in that sort of once-in-a-career moment.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I was told when I was in dispatch, I was always told, because, you know, I would say, well, I learned from my mistakes. And, you know, people would say, well, why don't you learn from others' mistakes so that you don't, you know, do the same thing later. So, yeah, I know what you mean.
Excellent point. Excellent point.
Yeah. So, you know, next joining with us as well is Ryan. If you can, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. Oh, I don't know that your sound is coming through. Are you there? Okay, hold on a minute here. Let me switch over here to the chat so that I can get you. Okay, so while we're figuring out Ryan's audio here, one of the first things we wanted to get into, Gary, is the Newtown 911 tapes. Now, there was a lot of different things that were going on with this whole situation where... Are you coming through?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay, there we go. Yeah, we can hear you now.
All right.
Okay. And you might have to turn your volume down just a bit because there's some feedback and echo from whenever I talk.
How's that?
It's a little better, yeah. So actually, if you want to go ahead and give us your introduction, and then we can get into the first topic.
Okay. I've been dispatching for about 2 years now in my 911 center. We're kind of small. We answer the call, we follow it all the way through and dispatch it. We don't do or have call taker dispatcher. I started running as a firefighter and just kind of worked my way up. And I do dispatching full time and I run EMS part time. That's what I do.
Nice. So for about 2 years then, and in that 2 years, you know, what have you found in dispatch that, I don't know, maybe surprised or shocked you?
That you can really go from, you know, a tragic incident to a very routine event within a matter of seconds. I could be working a structure fire or a fatal beep incident and then answer the phone and then someone's reporting that they lost their dog. So it's, the switch is pretty big. And it took me a little to get used to, but I finally, you know, got everything figured out.
Yeah, and you know, that is one thing that you know, people don't always get, is that, like you said, you can take the craziest call and then someone calls up for fireworks. And you're like, do you know what I just took right now? And you're calling a 911 for fireworks.
Yeah.
Well, welcome. I welcome the both of you to the show here. And like I said, we're going to get into this first topic, and it's about the Newtown 911 tapes. And this is from the Sandy Hook Elementary School, the shooting incident that happened there in Newtown, Connecticut. Gary, if you want to chime in first, what do you think about this, the controversy and why they were trying to keep the tapes, you know, kind of sealed there for a while?
Well, the state prosecutor was taking the point of view that these tapes were, if they had been released, would be very intrusive into the victims' families or friends. And on the other side, it was the Associated Press who was had immediately petitioned to obtain the tapes. This was just within days or hours of the incident.
Right.
So this, of course, initially there's a question of the investigation, and you know, there's a law enforcement investigation, and generally things aren't released during that investigation. Mm-hmm. So there was a period of time where they certainly weren't going to release the tapes, but once the investigation finished, the state was being handled on a state level. The state said, we don't want to release these tapes, and eventually it was appealed to the state. In Connecticut, there's a board, a commission that reviews requests for public information.
Right.
Not necessarily logging tapes, but any kind of information. And the commission said, legally, there is no basis to withhold these tapes. Mm-hmm. The state prosecutor was a little reluctant even after the ruling, and finally dropped his objection, and they released them. So with the warning to family and friends that all of these voices, in some cases, people who are not alive now, are going to be out there, and that if you don't want to hear them, you know, don't go to a website, don't click any buttons, don't listen to them. But the point, the AP's point was, we should be able to listen to these to judge the effectiveness of the public safety response.
Right.
And as it turns out, there was really very little question about the effectiveness. Mm-hmm. The dispatchers did an exemplary job. Things were handled rather efficiently. The dispatch of field units was made very quickly. And in general, I mean, there's still people questioning the element of when the officers got there, did they take timely action? That's all going to be worked out. But that's what the AP was trying to assess, and that was their argument. We should be able to listen to these tapes to judge the public safety response. And that's the question that comes up generally in other cases where people want to listen to tapes. You know, there's always this issue of the media listening and just sort of throwing it up on a website or on a TV news report somewhere and
right.
just playing it because it exists without any regard for response times or handling policies and procedures followed, that kind of thing. So that's certainly legitimate in the sense that you don't just want to play a tape just because you have it.
Yeah, exactly.
But then how do you balance some level of privacy or whatever you want to call it versus actually judging government to make sure it's working effectively.
Yeah, I kind of on the fence, I guess. I mean, I think they should have been released for sure for, you know, law enforcement, like you said, so that we can so we can learn from it, you know. And I listened to the tape, and it sounds like, you know, dispatch did great, and they were all calm, which was the best thing because, you know, that's what we have to do in situations like that. And I think they did a great job. And, you know, there's people calling and calling, and you can hear the gunshots in the background. And, you know, not once did you hear any of them, you know, like gasp or, you know, just falter in any way. So, but I do agree with you there that, you know, with bringing the tapes out and just throwing them on media, I've always thought working in dispatch that when something crazy happens, immediately they get the tapes, they throw it on the media, or they throw it on their websites, I mean, and that's when it starts, you know, like pulling the scab off. And, you know, people are hurt again. And so I can see that, you know, where they were trying to do that with this this incident in that sense. But, you know, we had to listen to them so that we could learn from it. What do you think about this, Ryan? Oh, he cut out again. Hey, Ryan, do you have a headset or anything with a microphone on it? Maybe if you plug that in, it'll pull up the sound. Yeah, see if you can check really quick. What do you think, Gary, were the, you know, probably the hardest things for, you know, the dispatchers taking these calls?
Well, I think also what he mentioned was going from 0 to 100.
Right. Yeah.
I am certain that it was a very quiet morning in Newtown, Connecticut when this occurred, and those kinds of routine, ordinary incidents, you know, were being reported, and then suddenly realizing that something horrific was occurring at the other end of the telephone line, mm-hmm. and knowing it seemed that they did realize, you know, in some cases. People will call and you will hear what they say, but it takes a second to kick in and you ask the question, are people shooting? Is that what you're saying? You know, mm-hmm. in this case, the tenor and the tone of the people calling, you know, there was basically no question that they knew exactly what was occurring, and right. that what they were describing was, you know, not a joke, not training. It was going on, so that 0 to 100 thing is probably the first thing that that really you know caught my ear.
Try to say something really quick, Ryan. See that if it's coming through. Try it again really quick here. Yeah, for some reason it's not coming through. And we continue to learn on this first hangout. Yeah, what can you do, especially when you're live? If you want to try again, Ryan, to, I guess, just the settings, there should be something up in the settings that'll say, you know, what to do for the microphone. And because it sounds like we can hear a little bit of what, you know, some feedback from you, but it's not coming through. I can see you down there moving your mouth, but it's not coming through at all. Yeah, the 0 to 100 factor and stuff like this. I've always said that taking a 911 call is, it's like being in a car, slamming on the gas, and letting go of the steering wheel, and that's just, you know, how it is sometimes when you're taking phone calls. Now, Gary, you had said that you were, you know, a dispatcher in the past. Do you remember any calls of, you know, any crazy calls?
Well, I should say that I live in Berkeley, California, and that's where I worked.
Okay.
And There's a sort of a nickname for Berkeley, and it's Berserkly.
Oh, geez.
So, in that sense, there are a lot of oddball calls, but you know, a lot of unfortunately, I don't remember a lot of the calls where people complained about their bad cheeseburger or those kinds of things.
Right.
usually, we had callers who were reporting things fairly legitimate, but you know, that's the range that one receives on 911 is pretty remarkable, even without the bad cheeseburger calls.
Right. Yeah, you know, there seems to be a lot of calls like that in the news lately. I don't know what it is, where, you know, people are calling for these, you know, ridiculous things. I don't know what they think is going to happen. you know, I think
the cheeseburger police are going to come out and do something.
Right.
I don't know. My general impression is that it varies by part of the country, or you know, even by city or county, that there's some areas where people's sense of an emergency or what's urgent is pretty well formed, and in others, 911 is sort of this cloud kind of thing, and I don't know what it is and what it does, but whatever problem I have, I'm going to give it a call. So I think it sort of varies by comm center. If you get a lot of those strange and inappropriate calls, or whether people are really focused and are dialing 911.
Right. You know, I remember taking a few calls where, you know, it was mostly because they were intoxicated, is what it was. You know, they're intoxicated, and they're at McDonald's, and they're calling because their order was screwed up, or the line's just taken too long, and of course, you know, we get there, and they're tanked, and we end up taking them in. So, I don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, the declining budgets mean that there's no such thing in America as a 911 education program. Years back, you would see billboards, or dispatchers would go to schools, or all sorts of, you know, printed material that they would hand out to various community events about. Here's 911. Here's what it does. There's no money to print anything. There's no money to send anybody anywhere to really have that kind of 911 education that tells people what it is, how to use it, and
right,
when it's appropriate to dial it.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of agencies with their websites that they try to do it, but you know, it's just a lot of text and everything. So I don't know if it is that the people are just not really getting into it, or because it's, and this is going to sound odd, but because it's too much reading, or what it is. But you know, there's got to be some sort of dedicated, you know, 911 educational program. You know, as you were saying, you know, something so that people can learn. And that's what I'm trying to do with, you know, this show too, because, you know, the public, you know, friends, family, whichever have listened. And one, you know, that I brought up a few episodes ago was a friend of mine that I went to school with. He ended up moving out to Hawaii, and he sent me a message, and he was saying that he was in a car accident, and he was upset with the dispatcher because he or she, whoever took the call, put him on hold, and he had called 911, and he was upset about it. Then he heard a few of the episodes, and you know, Whitney and I explaining why we put people on hold even when they're calling 911.
Yeah.
And in his email, he said, "I now understand. I understand it more now."
Exactly. And I guess I should say that staffing being what it is in many comm centers, putting somebody on hold is inevitable. There are just not enough people to answer so many calls to come in, and especially the way they arrive now, they just arrive in one big wave for,
right,
you know, one incident, and then in one other wave for another incident. So, yeah, what people's perception of just what you're trying to inform people that what's behind the phone line there and
right.
what's going on inside.
Now for people that were viewing or listening to this, Ryan, who was with us, his camera kept cutting out and everything, and the sound was messing up. So we've got a group chat here where we can talk to each other while this is going on. And he had asked if I wanted him to go ahead and sign out, and then we'll have him on another one once we figure out, you know, what is going on. And so we did that. So that's why he doesn't show up here on the screen anymore. He just backed out for now. And so it'll just be you and I, Gary, for the rest of this.
Now, okay.
Back to the Sandy Hook thing. When I was listening to the tape, I could have swore I heard a couple times one of the officers say, "I have one in custody." Now, did you happen to hear that too? Because I was just, I didn't understand that for a moment. And it seemed like in the recording, the calls were overlapped. Like there was one main dispatcher who had the call who kept talking to this one gentleman who called about three or four different times. But you could hear other calls going on and people answering and saying, you know, "This is so-and-so, we've got a, you know, an issue going on." So it seemed like it was all jumbled together in one call.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the calls were exactly assembled. I had assumed that it was you know, one call after each, but and I'm not sure how the communication center was set up. It seemed as if somebody was taking calls and, of course, giving information to other people. It was a little confusing. Now that you mention it, that I think those were the words I heard at some point as well.
Yeah, so I didn't know what they were talking about. I know I heard towards the beginning of it, one of the officers, it sounded like he was in pursuit of somebody. It sounded like he was yelling into the radio saying that there was somebody running into the woods. I mean, and it was really fast too, so I wasn't sure. But then, you know, after that, they're talking about someone was in custody. So I don't know how it all went down or anything. And just, you know, judging from the tape that I heard and just everything jumbled together. So,
definitely a hectic incident. I think that was one of the confusing response points, was that when they arrived, in all of these kinds of incidents, you have to assume that there's not just a single person. And again, we're talking sad situations here, but we're talking, you know, sort of reality. These incidents seem to be a single person, mm-hmm. Columbine notwithstanding, seem to be a single person and many times suicidal. And right. yet, that kind of profile can never be taken for granted. So, especially law enforcement has to you know, sort of broaden out their picture of a scene. Right. And so, as I recall, when they did arrive at the school, there's a wooded area around, like a large portion of the school, mm-hmm. and there were people who were in the woods for one purpose or another, and they saw people in the woods. And so even though they're getting information from people inside that something is going on there, you really have to sort of broaden to go 360 degrees and say, right. what else is happening? And these situations are, you know, very fluid, and it's always in the back of the mind of a law enforcement officer that they're carrying, you know, multiple weapons and mm-hmm. many times some sort of explosive device or incendiary device. So it can never be just one person with a pistol, say. It has to be multiple people with all kinds of potential weapons. And that can kind of slow down the response because you're encountering people outside and you're looking for all hazards kind of thing. So, in general, one of the most difficult types of situations from all levels, and that's just the law enforcement response.
Right.
There's a in some cases there's a fire response because of incendiary device or explosive devices, there is an enormously complicated EMS response to these things. Mm-hmm. And all of that kind of has to come in layers, one after the other. EMS can't come in or fire can't come in until the law enforcement has stabilized the scene.
Right, exactly.
And so the most complicated kind of incident that all of these agencies can handle, and especially the dispatchers. But I think, and we're talking about at the time of the incident, I want to emphasize that these incidents are, once, even after the incident is stabilized, the bulk of the incident then begins and carries out for days and months along. And, you know, in some cases, even years. But famously, when the Columbine High School incident occurred, the dispatcher there said their relatively small and relatively quiet communication center was mm-hmm. then besieged by the international press for days and days and days and weeks and months. And they would have to walk a gauntlet of reporters every day on their way to work. And this was, you know, 3 weeks after the incident, a month after the incident. And after the press scrutiny kind of faded away, the investigations of all sorts and interviews and you know, internal meetings and all you know, those kinds of things. And then perhaps the most dangerous part is the stress of having dealt with this incident and right. now actually having to go back and continue work. You know, nobody's giving you time off. The chair needs to be filled. Time off, you don't get that. You got to go back and deal with, as Ryan was saying, the barking dog, yeah. and the noise complaint, and the illegally parked car, and all of the routine things that your city or county has. So, and that stress, as we all know from lots of other occupations, that stress follows you and can affect you all the rest of your career.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So, as we listen to the logging tapes, we're hearing the incident occur, and we're hearing the response, and we know we're doing the best job that we can, but that is just very much the beginning of a long, long period of dealing with the incident afterwards.
Right. And that, you know, that makes sense as to why, you know, it took so long for them to release the tapes and, you know, not wanting to, like I said before, open that scab, you know, that wound, or to keep that wound open or anything like that. But, you know, you're talking about response times and everything, or, you know, just different agencies responding, that we can kind of segue into our next topic from there with response times. Now, listening to those tapes, it sounds like just from judging from the tapes, listening, it sounds like people got there right away. Like you were saying, it's a relatively small area there, so I'm sure they got there pretty quick. However, going into our next topic with definitions of response times, Detroit. Now, we were talking about it earlier. In Detroit, at one time, the average response time to an emergency was 58 minutes. And when I was in dispatch and I was taking just a medical with, and I don't mean not just a medical, every medical is, you know, is important, but, you know, a medical with somebody who's having heart problems or difficulty breathing or anything like that, you know, for me, if the, if EMS was taking, you know, like 5 minutes or something after the tone, just for them to say, we're en route, you know, that was in my head, like, you got to go faster, which I know they're going as fast as they can to get there. And that's what, you know, I would tell people all the time. But, you know, just that little bit of time was freaking me out. So with these emergency calls, it was taking 58 minutes to get there. Man, I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could work over there in the dispatch center.
Yeah, I assume that Detroit was measuring, you know, from priority one to whatever, priority five, 58 minutes. So It might be skewed a little, but what agencies are doing is they're reacting to staffing problems caused by financial problems. And right. Of course, in Detroit's case, they went bankrupt, so they've really got a financial problem. But even many other cities and towns of all sizes have got financial problems, mm-hmm. and so they've been trying to do the old expression, more with less.
Yeah.
And when they do that, response times are going to change. Now, the key element of Detroit and the Los Angeles Fire Department and New York City, what they've done is they've said, well, we're going to change the definition of response time. And mm-hmm. so as my longevity, I remember response time being when you picked up the phone call and when the unit got on scene. That was the response time. What they're now saying is, well, response time means how long did it take them to respond? That little portion of the entire incident from when they were dispatched to when they arrived used to be called travel time.
Yeah.
Now they're saying, well, our response time in Detroit's case is now just 8 or 9 minutes.
Yep. Well, I did see that.
I don't know if the citizens of Detroit would agree with that, because they're interested in how quickly did they get to my incident when after I dialed 911 for help.
Exactly.
So it's a bit of a chuckle how they're redefining the term in order to make it appear that the response time is doing better. The key element of any performance measure, and I'm sure agencies out there have all sorts, answer time, answer 90% of calls within 10 seconds, or
right.
Or again, response time, whatever it is, it has to be consistent over a long period of time, years, so that you can compare them as you go along. So that you can say in 2009, our response time was 6.5, and now it's 7.5, so that you can go to your county commissioners or city council or somebody and say, our response time is getting longer or better, whichever, and we need more staffing, or we're doing fine, or however you want to do it. But you have to have a consistency in the term and the measurement over a long period, not weeks and months, but years. That's how you do any performance measure in any industry. So as soon as you start redefining the term, now none of the statistics that you've gathered previously can be compared. Right. And it makes the performance measurement just pretty much useless, besides trying to hide the lengthening time.
Right.
There was a long investigation in Los Angeles by the Los Angeles Times, and they found that EMS response times were getting longer, but that the fire department was their redefinition of the term was concealing that fact, and it appeared that the times were actually getting shorter. So there was a rather more than a controversy in Los Angeles, and this Detroit redefinition kind of feeds back into all of their financial troubles, and you know, perfectly understandable.
Right.
So if you have a term, stick with it. If it's getting longer, you live with it and try to do better. But don't redefine the term. It first of all, it makes the performance measure useless, but eventually somebody's going to notice that
right.
redefinition, and you look pretty foolish afterwards.
Oh, and that's what I was going to ask too just now. I was going to ask, you know, how do you think that makes these agencies look when they're redefining things to, you know, make it look like the times, the response times are a lot shorter?
Well, I think in some, well, at the least, it makes you look foolish, but
right.
it could very easily make it look like you're trying to conceal something. And from an administrative point of view, I better make these times look better or I'll get fired or I'll get replaced or something like that. So I don't think there's doesn't sound like a criminal act, but it certainly puts a public safety administration in a position of having to explain why did you do it now at the point where why didn't you just come and say, hey, we need three more engine companies or something.
Right.
Generally, all of these agencies are operating with fewer stations or fewer units. Mm-hmm. And especially for a fire department, the original distribution of units around the jurisdiction were made, the fire stations are placed in particular locations mm-hmm. to equal out the response time to all points in the jurisdiction. As soon as you take one of those locations out of the mix, you've increased the response time. So, you know, there's a policy of brownouts where each day they will close one station. And so some part of the city is going to have a longer response time. That's pretty common. And cities live with that generally, hoping that nothing happens within today's brownout territory.
Right.
In some cases, they have longer term station closures, but the locations are rather, they're picked particularly. So closing one temporarily or closing one semi-permanently changes the whole mix of for response times, and that can be, if you're in that area, you're in for a longer response time.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Now with Detroit, you know, with them going going bankrupt and everything, I saw in one of those articles was that they ended up pulling off all of their sworn-in officers who were working in the communications center as dispatch. Now that was that 100 that they pulled off, or did they hire 100 civilians to work in the dispatch center? I don't remember which part that was.
Well, they're amazingly, perhaps, Detroit has finally come to the conclusion that they need to civilianize a project that many, many other cities have already accomplished. Mm-hmm. They have hired, I believe it's just the first 15 civilians to civilianize. I believe they have 150 total officers in the communications center. So the project will take some time to convert over, but they've finally seen that they need to move these people with badges and guns and training, to handle field incidents mm-hmm. out of the communications center and put them out in the field, and that they are able to train people who don't wear a badge to do the same job and perhaps do it better. Well, go ahead. I'll say that I'm my first dispatching job was mm-hmm. in a fire department, in the Berkeley Fire Department.
Okay.
The period where they civilianized their fire alarm center. They had separate police and fire, and I was in, they had hired three people to replace firefighters as a pilot project, mm-hmm. and that worked so well for a year that they said, okay, we're going to civilianize completely, and I was hired in a group that then completely civilianized the fire alarm center. So that was mid-70s. So the city of Berkeley figured it out a long time ago.
Right.
Many other cities are still working to convince themselves that we can train people to do this job and know about it, everything, and they're not firefighters and they're not police officers. I should add that I did climb a ladder to the top of the training tower in order to complete my dispatcher training. So they made sure that we understood the field situation mm-hmm. and what it was like and what was going on out there as much as possible. We didn't done any protective gear and fight fires, but they took extra measures to sort of to give us the training that they felt comfortable giving us, that then would convince themselves, yeah, they've been out there, they've been in a firehouse, they know what's about. So we feel comfortable with them being in the fire alarm office, and I think that's what agencies need to do. Is they obviously, just to me, obviously civilians can do dispatching as well as, and quite frankly, usually better than sworn officers or firefighters or deputies.
Right.
But the agency needs to be convinced some way that that's true, and hiring good people and them doing a good job and you know, sort of convincing in the early stages is key to that.
Yeah, that's always good. I know the dispatch center that I used to work for, that's how we did it. When we had, and actually it started with our new training coordinator. When she came on, we started doing more of that. So the dispatchers would come on, and there was a portion of the training where they would, ride along with an officer. They would ride along with EMS. I'm not sure if they did a lot with fire, but they also went into the jail, and they would be there for a few hours and see how they work everything, and so that we could get a feel of how everything goes around and how, we are the first responder, but it's us learning everything else too, so that we're comfortable when those types of calls come in, and we know, okay, I know exactly, not exactly what they're going through, but pretty much what's going on,
yeah.
So that they can relate with it better.
I mean, at the least, just being able to hear how they hear the radio at the other end helps you, realize when I'm talking, they're hearing on a loudspeaker at the fire station, or they're hearing on an earpiece in their, on their portable radio or speaker in the car. Just being able to know how is my voice received at the other end kind of gives you a clue that I've got to speak slowly and clearly. And so there are a lot of experiences in the field that you would never understand unless you get out there and sort of hear it from the reverse direction.
Right, exactly. And I know that a few times that I have been with officers doing ride-alongs, actually the first time, and I heard dispatch come over the radio, I sat there for a moment, I looked at the officer, and I said, do I sound like, that's what I sound like? Like that, it sounds a lot different hearing it on that end.
Or, the inflection, or I shouldn't be carrying my emotions on the radio as much as I
right.
am.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. You can hear it, and it's the same way on the other end. Especially, working with the officers as much as you do, and you build these friendships. You know how they are, and the way they sound, but they have just that one difference in their voice, and something is going on. So it's always good to hear, both ends, and have that friendship too, or get to know the officers and, fire and EMS that you're working with.
Exactly. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I had particular officers that I knew that they would make a car stop, and if their voice raised, I knew, whoop, boop, start sending some cover. something was going on.
Yeah, exactly. Now, moving on to our next topic, there's this one of the topics that you had brought up, and it has to do with Nina in California. And there was an article that came out about the reliability of 911, and it, was it the locations, the accuracy of the locations, and that's coming in with wireless, right?
It was. There were a couple of the California chapter of the National Emergency Number Association, NENA, discovered that there were fewer and fewer 911 calls being delivered to comm centers with location information, so that dispatchers would pick up the call, and typically you get some sort of display,
right,
depending on how your equipment is arranged, either a point on the map or even latitude and longitude or whatever. Mm-hmm. They discovered that statistically they were able to go to the state and say, download all the 911 call data, and California, it comes to a central point, and they're reporting it by you know, statewide. And they looked and they said, you know, we're getting fewer locations through the these are wireless calls,
right,
through the wireless call system, the carriers, you know, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, so forth. We're getting fewer locations. And not so much that the accuracy of the location was getting worse, but actual fewer locations were being reported each time. So they naturally were concerned and started a campaign, and they contacted the FCC. And so far, there's been no technical explanation from the carriers as to why this is occurring. There's been some talk that the location takes a period of time to come in, to be transmitted, to be determined by the handset, and to be transmitted through. But as after California reported this, then the FCC has been collecting data from states on a statewide basis,
okay,
about this issue. And what they found is some other states have also been have a declining number of calls with a location, a latitude and longitude being reported.
So you're talking phase one and phase two, both of them then?
Well, what actually happens, fewer phase two, actually.
Oh, okay.
Fewer and phase then in some cases it drops back to one, but even, I believe, even it's dropping back to zero, that there are fewer phase one calls as well. Just in general, fewer locations. So, again, there's some talk that dispatch, it takes a time for the call to the location information to come up through, and that perhaps the dispatcher should be re-polling the system, re-bidding the system, re-asking, right, send me location information again. So there may be some sort of semi-technical explanation there, or... And this is sort of the question, are people simply calling from more oddball locations where the location isn't capable of being determined and transmitted?
Right.
And one of those locations is just more indoor calls. This is the big question. So, I mean, I think that's the easy explanation is, well, as people are absolutely more dependent on wireless for their 911 calls. Mm-hmm. I think the national figure is maybe up to 70% of 911 calls are coming in on wireless devices now.
Yes.
It's off the charts, or almost off the charts. But if that's occurring, if 70% are coming by wireless, you know, that has to mean more indoor calls. And of course, since the vast majority of location information is coming from the satellite system, the GPS system. There are other ways of determining location, but the majority are being done by GPS. Then there is no GPS indoors, so that means
right,
no location. So California, the California NHTSA chapter has kicked off this question, and the FCC has taken it up. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to gather more data at this point, but I guess the first question that came to my mind is, what is the maximum number of calls, the percentage that ultimately will be reported in a 911 system? If we, as time goes on, it'll level out to some percentage,
right?
As people call from, you know, the Grand Canyon and Manhattan and you know, Des Moines, Iowa and Nebraska and everywhere, points at sea and, you know, and from an airplane, who knows? What will be the natural percentage of calls that arrive with a location? Mm-hmm. At some point, it might be 70, you know, it might be 70%, might be 60%. And if it is, what are you going to do about it? There's some cases there's just no solution. And of course, it will revert back to the person to say, here's where I am.
Right. Yeah.
It, it may come to the point where we just say, we don't know where you are, but you're there, so you tell us where you are.
Yeah,
there's... and I appreciate your chuckle there, because that's occurring now.
Right. Yeah.
More people are calling us on the phone, having no idea where they are.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's one of the biggest problems now is that, you know, we've got all these smartphones, and you've got map programs, you got GPS, everything. You can figure out where you're at on your phone, but I think sometimes we get too dependent on their phones, and I will take that to be myself. I'm dependent on my phone sometimes, but
absolutely.
I think that's one of the things, is that people are getting too dependent on their smartphones, and, well, I've got all this information at the palm of my hand. Well, when it doesn't work, nobody pays attention to cross streets anymore. People don't pay attention to landmarks. I used to tell my brother all the time when I was first teaching him how to drive, I would say, when you're somewhere, just, of course, pay attention to the road, but also pay attention to your surroundings, If you know that this McDonald's is on the corner of whatever, or, this store or anything like that, keep that in mind, because if you ever have an emergency and you really don't know where you're at least you'll know your landmarks or, some of the crossroads or anything like that. So, like I said, one of the things, just people are getting too dependent on those phones. And you're right, it might get to that point where we're just saying, you just need to tell me what you see around you, because, us as dispatchers, we remember things. And if it's an area that we know of, we hear something, something that will trigger, the light bulb, so to speak, and we'll know exactly where you're at because we've worked in that area for so long. But, yeah, with, calls not coming in right with information and stuff like that, we'd have to ask them, where exactly are you? Please, please, people who are watching this or listening to this, know where you're at, because that'll just help you out more.
It's a routine frustration for dispatchers to talk to somebody who is truly having an emergency of some sort, but then not being aware. And there are legitimate reasons for them not knowing. There have been these very tragic cases where people are traveling along Interstate 12 somewhere, and they either suffer a medical emergency or they fall asleep or whatever. Their car veers off the road.
Right.
It goes into a bushes or a wooded area, or even, a pond or something, and they are truly unaware of where they were. They know they were on Interstate 12, but they literally they did not see the previous exit sign. Nothing is visible from them. So there are these cases where people land in places where they can't see anything, they can't see landmarks, don't know where they are. But other times people will say, well, I'm in a car, I'm at the corner. Well, and without any other information.
Yeah, what corner?
One of the best tricks I heard was the dispatcher was talking to somebody, and they had a true emergency, and they were in the street, I believe, and they asked the person, do you see any cars nearby? And they say, yes. Well, read me off a license plate.
Ah, very clever, yes.
They took the license plate, they ran the registration of the license plate. Fortunately, it was one of those areas, a residential area, where they're parked in front of their own home. They ran the plate, they look at the address, they go, that's where the person is. I've heard the trick is, they're inside a house, but they don't know the address. Is there any mail, sitting on the table or somewhere? Now there's a lot less mail. People are emailing, but there are I've heard a lot of interesting tricks to get a landmark, or, do you see a church steeple, or something that is visible from a distance kind of thing. Or, in a particular town, there might be a smokestack or some sort of, structure that's visible throughout, a water tower throughout the whole town. And, what word can you see on the water tower, And they say, well, I can see city of, that tells them, okay, that's facing south, so this person must be, shouldn't have to do all of those kind of tricks, of course.
Right.
But you do what you got to do. So the FCC is looking into this. They're not sure if it's technical, if it's, shall we say, behavioral, because by 911 callers. But at some point, as we all know, radio is very kind of iffy. The connections are always even with the two-way radios that police and fire use. Sometimes you can hear, sometimes you can't. That's just the way radio waves operate.
Right.
And smartphones operate on radio. So at some point, we're going to come to a sort of an understanding that we can only find people 72% of the time. And it for the other percentage, those people are going to have to come up with their own location when they dial 911.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder if some of those phones or the calls that are coming in without all the information are the, you've got the throwaway phones, the ones that you just go and you buy and you put minutes on it. And, when I was in dispatch, those calls would come in and they would never, usually didn't come up with any information at all. We would get lucky if, phase one would come up. But then, then with that, you've just got the tower. So then that's when, like we were saying, we're relying on the landmarks and all these other, tricks that can be done, which I have tried the mail before. I remember hearing someone say that, and I started saying the same thing because it's a good thing. Somebody's there. I'm visiting a friend, and they're down, and I don't know what's wrong with them. We need an ambulance. Well, get a piece of mail somewhere. You can get an address, and pretty much every time it worked. But, back to these phone calls, it makes me wonder if it's just one of those things, if it's one of those prepaid phones that you can just buy and throw away, the ones that really can't be tracked.
Right. I'm sure that there are still a ton of old phones still in circulation that are just, 12 years old or something that people are still using, and that just don't have the technology to accurately report their location. So it's dealing with everybody, but consumer or customer point of view, they don't care about any of this. They just want to be able to open up their flip phone that they bought 12 years ago and press 911, and then somebody will appear beside them, with a fire hose or a gun or some defibrillator to take care of their emergency. And it goes back to those missing 911 education programs. There has to be some sort of flow of information back to people that says, we'll go anywhere, and we'll send anything. We'll send a helicopter. We'll send, a bulldozer. Anything that we need to help you. Mm-hmm. You've got to do this much to get the ball rolling, and you can't depend 100% on us. Some part of cellular 911 will always be unlocatable, and help us out.
Yeah. Yeah, I know I've had people, not of course not this winter right now because I'm not in dispatch anymore, but last year during wintertime, I had somebody who was on the trails out in the woods, and we've got large game areas in the county that I worked in, and they were just completely lost, and they called me on a phone that was a prepaid one, and there wasn't any information on it, and I got a lashing about why I cannot find them. And so I started, going through everything, what was the last road you were on? And we did end up finding him. I mean, it took, the officer going out there and hitting his siren and having the lights on for them to be able to, figure out where they were at and walk to him. But, it goes along with that education thing. They thought that I would be able to hook them up with anything that they needed, and it doesn't always work like that. Like you said, the general public doesn't really care about the back stuff. It's just, I got this awesome phone, and I hear GPS can find everybody, so they're going to be able to find me no matter what. But in that case, I heard a lot. My ear was bleeding by the end.
the wireless carriers have spent billions of dollars on their systems, and then we end up using the old siren trick.
Yeah, right.
That'd be hard to explain to the county commissioners what's going on with the technology here. Sometimes the most primitive thing works best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Now, actually, this is a good segue into one of the last things that we had. FirstNet. Now, this is a huge. It's a nationwide wireless data network. With what we were just talking about, do you think once this is fully implemented, if it goes through, of course, will this help in a way, with us being able to find people better?
Well, that's a good question. FirstNet, it goes way back to the allocation of certain spectrum to public safety. The Congress recognized that data flowing for public safety was going to be very important, and data could be anything, just like we're using data now for video and audio connection, but it could be data like NCIC. It could be video, could be photos, could be any kind of information. And what they set aside spectrum for that purpose, data, and they set it aside nationwide. They wanted their vision. The Congress said, we want to build a system nationwide that carries public safety data. So it took a while for the spectrum to be allocated and a lot of administrative things, as you can imagine. And where we are now is that they've created an entity to administer this project, and it's called FirstNet, one word, and it's run under the National Telecommunications and Information Agency, NTIA. And where they are is the point of this topic is to explain that it's very complicated and it's very broad and it's very difficult to follow because it's a federal program. It's difficult to follow in the sense that it's got a lot of tentacles. So right now they have a board that is managing it, and the board is putting together their administrative structure, and they're starting to decide how to fund it. They're starting to decide technical standards on how this wireless data network is going to operate. As you can imagine, there are all sorts of radio and technical issues about standards and whatever. So at some point, they're going to be moving out towards the states to say, how do you want to set it up? And then it will generally be roughly a kind of another, like a national data carrier, much like a existing cellular carrier is now. There'll be some differences, but again, this is data only, not voice communications. They're working to build out this system so that literally every point in America will have access to this system. And it would mean two things. One, that any agency that wants to put a laptop in their car and receive, say, video surveillance images from a bank, or to look up a person's photo, from their state criminal justice database or NCIC, or look at fingerprints, whatever data that you want, you'll be able to get. Small towns, large cities. The infrastructure will be there, and all you would have to do is supply the laptop or other device, could be a smartphone even, and connect to this system. And there will probably be some, sort of monthly fee, perhaps, to connect to it. But generally, it will bring public safety data to every small and large place. The other interesting part is that you'll be able to, because it's one system, you could theoretically intercommunicate with other agencies, say in the same county or the same state or, at large incidents. I suppose you could, a patrol car in Tennessee could talk with a patrol car in Colorado if that need came up.
That's pretty awesome.
But it would be more interoperability within, a smaller area with several cities together, or a county emergency, or any kind of incident. So it's coming. It will, will eventually hit every little place. For now, it's difficult to find to track this because it's such a huge project. You know, the major news organizations, just it's too specific for them to cover. Right. You have to kind of look around to find information. So there's as I said, the NTIA is the agency that in the federal government is sort of handling of the Department of Commerce, I think. So they have a website, and it's NTIA.gov, and that'll get you to the NTIA site, and under that you look for public safety, and then FirstNet is under that. The other, my website covers it in sort of higher level detail, but there are a lot of things going on underneath that are interesting. And the publication that's really kind of keeping track of it is Urgent Communications. And their website is urgentcommunications.com. If you want to keep track of FirstNet, it will eventually bring you data. Those are the two links to keep track of it.
All right. And also, you know, for people who are watching this and listening on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and Spreaker and all, we'll also end up putting all of the links that you have and, you know, for your website as well on the blog post as well as on our social media outlets. So, you know, would you consider this more of the word that's always being thrown around, the next gen 911? Is it, you know, and is there some sort of timeline or anything for this? That you know of?
Well, this it'll be wireless data, and there have been a few setbacks here and there, as any large federal program has. Mm-hmm. But we're probably talking the first implementation will probably be maybe in a couple of years. It's hard to tell, but we're talking about establishing an entire nationwide network of data. Infrastructure. So we're probably talking a good 5 years before we get any kind of real larger system going. It just depends on how they implement it. There's some talk that they're going to build a separate system. There's talk that they may actually pair up with a wireless cellular carrier to handle some of the towers and data flow and everything, which would probably shorten the implementation time. But It's a little longer term project.
Gotcha. Well, one of the last things I want to talk about is it goes with the next gen type thing that's going to be coming here very fast. And there's a lot of states that are already doing this. Indiana, for one, they're doing a text from 911. So I wanted to get your take on what you think about texting 911.
Oh, excellent topic, and let's see if I can summarize it.
Okay.
The interesting part about text to 911 is it did not originate from public safety. It came from the House of Representatives and the Senate, in general. What our politicians were hearing was. People want to text a 911. People, I have more power in my smartphone here than I have, you know, I want to be able to use all of that power.
Right.
And so neither of the two public safety organizations suggested this. Their warrant communication center said, oh, what we need is people texting us with emergencies. Nobody said that because comm centers are occupied with other things. They're trying to staffing and funding and upgrading and there are 100 issues that they're worried about. But it came from sort of an outside Washington-based point of view that people should be allowed, you should be able to text to 911. So the FCC got involved, some other federal agencies got involved, and so that capability sort of came to public safety and says, okay, it's coming, get ready for it. And everybody's going, well, you know, we're still, as we're talking about wireless 911 locations, we're still trying to figure out wireless 911. You know, now we have to do a text. Some agencies have embraced it and tackled it and have implemented it sort of on an interim basis with maybe one or two wireless carriers. But it hasn't been a big thing. And in fact, I can't remember the state. There have been a couple of states that have done it on the East Coast, and they've had very, very, very few people text 911. They've only been on maybe one or two carriers, and they tried it out for a year, and I think they got maybe two texts in a year that were of any, you know, incident-related message kind of thing.
Right.
So there really isn't a lot of public interest at this point in doing it. The selling point has been, and I acknowledge this, the selling point has been there are situations where somebody cannot or does not feel comfortable in making a voice call to report an emergency.
Right.
And the types of incidents that they are, that the supporters of text to 911 are giving are trapped in the trunk of a car, speeding down the highway, can't make a voice call. I'll text 911. Or my house is being burglarized and I'm hiding under the bed and can't make a voice call. Or the suspects will hear me.
Right.
So there have been a couple of these kinds of incidents, maybe two or three example incidents where we want people to be able to text the 911. Absolutely, those are legitimate uses of it, but those are fairly rare types of incidents and fairly rare uses of the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it will eventually come and it will eventually be useful, but it's sort of moving full speed ahead faster than public safety knows how to deal with it. And this has occurred before. Cellular was the same way. The cellular companies came up with the cellular phones, and they didn't consult public safety 1 minute. They simply said, oh, if you dial 911, we're just going to route it to 911. And literally, people, dispatchers everywhere started getting these calls. They go, what are they and where are they coming from? Well, we don't know anything about this. And it took years and years and years and a lot of FCC work and regulation to put back on the carriers the burden of sending wireless 911 calls to us correctly, right, with a location, phase one, phase two, or, you know, information about the subscriber, you know, phone numbers where we can call the carrier. So it's moving faster than public safety can really get a handle on it. There are a whole bunch of, there are technical issues, of course, but once the texts start coming in, every agency will have to start writing in rules and regulations, policies, about how do you handle these texts. There's a whole, there are pages now. What do you do when you get a hang-up call or a silent 911 call, voice call? You have to. Do you call them back? Do you look for the subscriber information? You know, there are ways of handling these, standard ways of handling these kinds of calls. At some point, they're going to have to write policies and procedures. When you get a text and it says, "Hi, I'm being stabbed and whatever," is it a prank? Is it real? If it is real, how do you know where they are? Location. There's a lot of work to be done. And yet there seems to be pressure to implement it as soon as possible. So those are opposing forces kind of thing.
Right.
And for a relatively few number of incidents that occur, albeit critical incidents, but those incidents don't come up very often.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk as well, though, that it would definitely benefit the hearing and speaking impaired. That, you know, they'll have a better way to talk with 911, and as of right now, you know, people who are watching or listening to this, I know I've spoken to people. I actually just spoke to somebody recently. I went to get my hair cut, and I was talking to them. They were asking me what I do, and I was telling them, and I started talking about text to 911, and they said, "Well, I didn't even know that was that was around, and I said, yeah, well, if you text 911 and, you know, that there's nothing is available there, you'll get an automatic bounce back message. So, you know, if you didn't know that, for the people who are listening or watching, you know, if you text 911, there will be a bounce back message, and it'll say, you know, something to the effect of, you know, text 911 is not available, you know, call 911 for your emergencies. And that was something that the big, you know, main carriers all agreed on. And then is it May 15, 2014? Is that when, I guess, dispatch centers are supposed to be equipped with receiving or, you know, initiating text messages?
In 14, I'm not sure that the implementation is in 14. That may be the deadline for the bounce back. They've actually implemented bounce back sort of voluntarily.
Right, yeah.
Without regulation. I mean, that's going to be part of the process, is some sort of outreach to people, text to 911 education. Mm-hmm. When do you use this? What do you need? How will it work? An enormous amount of public education has got to be associated with this,
right,
to know when it is appropriate to use it and what are the limitations. You're correct about the hearing impaired or speech impaired people who will have a direct connection. I should say that when the next generation of 911 comes in, it's going to be IP based, and it should part of that will a piece of that will be sort of computer to 911 connection. Mm-hmm. So that, as we all know, the old TTY device with the two suction cups and putting the handset and the, if you ever, those old ones, that arrow will sort of disappear.
Right.
And in the next generation of 911, it will be integrated sort of with in a computer sense, so that anybody who needs to or feels comfortable in typing can go. It's text to 911 plus one or something, you know. You'll be able to just go to your computer keyboard and go, I have an emergency and, you know, hearing impaired, and it will just be like typing on sending a text message, a chat message, more of a chat message kind of thing, which is even better than text. People with iPhones now, it's iMessage. You can just sort of chat in real time,
right,
back and forth. And I think that's one of the issues of text messaging. What kind of abbreviations and exchanges are going to occur reporting an emergency? Again, if you're trapped in the back of a car and all you have is a text message, go for it. And, right, and, you know, dispatchers will do the best they can.
Exactly.
But you can imagine a lot of communications issues, and I'm not talking radio waves, I'm talking what are they saying here, you know, abbreviations or misspellings, or it could get pretty difficult to interpret some of the text messages that people will send. And I sort of am of the opinion that once text messaging becomes live, every prankster and every person who wants to do something bad will be texting dispatchers with bizarre and strange and ridiculous messages. So we'll see about that.
Definitely.
You know, the old thing, if you can do it, you know, they will do it. So.
Right.
Once the capability comes up, it should be interesting to see what kind of text messages arrive.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what I want to do now, I want to show you this video. It's something that I actually created for the company that I work for, and it's a text from 911. So it's outbound texting or dispatch initiated, and it's been on the website and for the company, and it's on, you know, YouTube and everything. So I want to pull it up here, and I believe this is actually going to be you know, the first time that others are going to be seeing it besides, you know, department heads. And I asked my boss yesterday, I said, you know, I'm doing this episode and I wanted to bring up, you know, Text to 911 and everything. I wanted to see if I could play the video. And I got the okay, so I'm going to, once I click this, it should bring up a YouTube screen for you, or say that I've pulled it up, and you know it'll give you an option to say yes or no so that you can see it as well. So let me pull it up here. And let me know if you see anything.
I'm checking the screen, and let's see. Okay. I do it.
Okay, can you see the video?
Let's see.
911, where's your emergency? Hello? Hello, this is 911.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's just an intro video to Texty, which is a text right now, text from 911 platform that Indiana is using now. It's not the entire state. There's several counties who have signed up, and more are going through. And there's a possibility that it might go statewide for Indiana, but that's what the text from 911 looks like that dispatchers are using. So yeah, I guess, you know, what do you think?
Well, I like it. The map component is, I think, also a key feature, because that's been a question of texting is just text, and adding some location component to that would be pretty important.
Right. Yeah, so that's, you know, for people who are watching, that's what it's going to look like. You know, for those in Indiana, that's what it looks like. You know, I don't know all the other scopes of how far it's going, but as for Indiana, you know, that's what text from 911 is looking like. And then later on, it'll be inbound as well. So then it'll be text to 911. But that's a platform that Indiana is working on. And you know, as we go into the wrap up of this, you know, Gary, just thank you very, very much for doing this for our first hangout. And you know, is there anything else that you would like to add before we end the session here?
Well, I guess I would make the pitch to check out the website 911dispatch.com. And it's really, as the original founder, Alan Burton, he said it was just for dispatchers. I'm writing really for people at a console level, and for, you know, sort of what they need to know to do better and sort of have a better career.
Excellent. So definitely everybody check out the website. There's excellent stories on there, and you've helped us out, and I thank you very much for that. You know, both of those press releases, I tell everybody when I tell the story of how this started, the whole show started, I credit you as being the one to actually get me past that, the mark that I needed. I mean, I only had 36 hours left, and you know, we talked, and you but just that, you know, it was just enough, you know, to say everything that was going on. And overnight, I surpassed the mark. So thank you very much for that help. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. And yes, I appreciate all the work you're doing to get people a better view of dispatchers and dispatching.
Thank you very much. Now, for people watching or listening, as always, if you have any questions, comments, or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email the show. And now, before I was just, I had two different emails. The first one was the jcast@jeverlog.com. That one has been getting completely flooded with spam, and for some reason, the filter is not catching it. So I've destroyed it. It's no longer there. We are only using wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is @901podcast. You can find us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And, you know, for our podcast promotion in the beginning, make sure to check out 901trainer.com. Like I said before, they've got excellent information on there and training simulations and such. And there's just a whole heap of stuff that you can find out there. And this will be posted up on our YouTube channel, and it'll be posted up on the blog, and you can hear it on iTunes, Spreaker, and Stitcher Radio, and available 24/7. So have a good one, everybody.
You just listened to Within the Trenches on the Code 7 Podcast Network. If you have any questions or like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.